You must see it clear. You are against war, that means you are against war ever.
The Ba'ath Party was a very fascist party that ruled with terror, including the practice of terror on its own members.
As we all know, in the 80s, the African National Congress was considered a terrorist organization. So if this law existed then, if you supported the ANC monetarily, you could be stripped of your citizenship. It's very scary.
I would have preferred a mixture of intelligence and bribery, which would have had far more chance of finding the fiendishly horrible Osama bin Laden.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, May 12, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The scientist known as Dr. Germ and a top leader in Saddam Hussein's armed forces has surrendered to U.S. forces. Dr. Rahib Rashid Taha, a scientist who helped Iraq make weapons out of anthrax, surrendered over the weekend, according to Major Brad Lowell of the U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida. Pentagon officials say also in custody today is Ibrahim Ahmad Ab al-Sattar Mohammed, armed forces chief of staff since 1999. Officials did not release details of his capture. The two could know much about an unconventional weapons program the government had, but it was far from certain what kind of information they would divulge to American interrogators. Other former senior leaders have largely denied under questioning that the country had programs for biological, nuclear, or chemical weapons, the Bush administration rationale for waging the war. Indeed, no weapons of mass destruction have been found. The man handpicked by the Bush administration to head up the U.S. colonization of Iraq, L. Paul Bremer, said upon his arrival in the capital today that his goal is to help Iraqis regain control of their own destiny after decades of rule by Saddam Hussein. Bremer, a former State Department official, arrived with the official he is replacing, retired Army Lieutenant General Jay Garner. In a joint interview, both men denied there was any premature breakup of the Iraq Reconstruction Group while acknowledging that one senior member was leaving early. Bremer said diplomat Barbara Bodine, who was coordinator for Central Iraq, including Baghdad, within the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, was being reassigned back to Washington by the State Department for their own reasons. He did not elaborate. Garner denied reports that he, too, was departing earlier than planned. Meanwhile, over the weekend, General Tommy Franks, the man originally intended to be the mayor of Baghdad, declared Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party officially dead, and Iraqis were told to collect and turn in any materials they had relating to the party and its operations, calling them an important part of Iraqi government operations. Abbas Kahim is an Iraqi-American who joined the uprising against Saddam Hussein after the 1991 Gulf War. He shared his reaction to the news of the Ba'ath Party's demise with Peace Watch earlier today.
Well, the Ba'ath Party has been dead before the this announcement. It didn't take Mr. Franks to declare it. The Ba'ath Party is a very or was a very fascist kind of a party that ruled with terror, including the practice of terror on its own members. The junior ones, and it was this kind of a pyramid where the weight becomes higher and higher as you go to the bottom. The recruitment of it was mandatory among the young students. In fact, some of them are recruited or mandated to join the party, starting with the seventh grade on. And they are signed or made to sign on agreements with the party that they would subject themselves to execution if they desert the party or join another one. Mm. So this is the kind of party it was. And I think the moment the regime collapsed and the higher elite strata of the party lost power, the party was already dead.
Mm. Well, the Ba'ath Party dominated Iraqi politics for the past 35 years or so, and thousands of civil servants were affiliated with the party. Can you describe just how much influence it had or continues to have in the country?
The party had many problems in its past history. it didn't sit well with a lot of people. The only appeal it had was its anti-imperialist slogans. And I don't think that it is unique right now in the Iraqi arena. Almost all the parties that are describing themselves as patriotic share the same appeal. So the party does not have advantage in that. However, it has the disadvantage of terrible past. And again, because it was imposed on the majority of its members, I'm sure a lot of people are very happy that they don't have to give allegiance to the party anymore. So, again, I don't think that the party has any viability right now. And if it does, then probably it needs to be reformed and reintroduced, repackaged to the people, and it will take a lot of time to create trust again. I mean, the theory of the party from the point of view of Arab nationalists is not bad. It is the what discredited the party and its theory was the practice that was flawed, almost like what Stalinism did to the socialist theory and the communist theory. There is this gap that seems to prevent any consistency between the theory and the practice.
There is a phrase that we use here and that goes, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Are you saying don't throw the baby out with the bath water in this instance, perhaps?
Well, I think there isn't any baby left in the party because the corruption came to the core of the practices of the rank and file of the party. So I don't think that this proverb will apply anymore because, again, the damage has been done to the party in so many ways, and including the complete loss of trust and any bridges between the party and the people. And again, the theory became some kind of it's like a target of ridicule for anyone because again it has been for so long a time discredited and desecrated by fascist kind of practices that people right now have huge resentment towards the party. They don't even want to hear the name of the Ba'ath Party.
What kind of party or ideology is likely to spring up in the absence of the Ba'ath Party, in your opinion?
I think the shadow parties or those that were underground during the Ba'ath time would probably have great chances. Right now, the continuum of the Iraqi political culture spans between the communist-like parties, including the Iraqi Communist Party, which has some following in Iraq, and all the way to Islamic parties, and I think the latter, the Islamic parties, have much more support right now in Iraq because, again, of the religiosity of the people to begin with, and also because of the ban that the regime and the Ba'ath Party put on any religious activities, that the people were kept thirsty for any kind of religious freedom. And right now, a lot of parties are gaining support, and they have the Ba'ath Party and its brutal ways to thank. The Communist Party, I don't think it will have much success because, again, it does not have a lot of association with the average Iraqi. They have a group of Iraqis who were mentally ready to accept the party and its ideology, and once they reach that level, it will be diminishing returns. They will not have many more joiners, but I think the lion's share, so to speak, will be for the Islamic parties, and I think probably the ones, if the United States is careful, we will have the better scenario, which is mainstream Islamic parties that are loyal to Islam and not hostile to the West in a very hard way. If the United States keeps micromanaging Iraqi affairs and preventing Iraqis from doing what they want, we will have a reaction that is harsher, and I think we will have parties that are much more hostile to the United States and confrontational.
Abbas Kadim is an Iraqi-American who joined the uprising against Saddam Hussein after the 1991 Gulf War. He's currently a lecturer at the University of California at Berkeley. Britain's Secretary of State for International Development, Claire Short, who fiercely criticized British Prime Minister Tony Blair over Iraq, quit her job today. Blair's office said Short rang the premier on Monday morning to tell him of her decision. According to Blair's office, Baroness Amos, a junior foreign office minister, would replace the outspoken Claire Short. Before the invasion of Iraq was launched, Short labeled Blair reckless for his hawkish stance and said she would resign if a UN resolution authorizing military action were not secured. That resolution never came, but Short backtracked and decided to stay in the job she loved. She was highly regarded in the aid community and across the developing world. Three other ministers, former Foreign Secretary Robin Cook and two junior ministers, resigned before the war in protest. Remarks by veteran Parliament member Tam Dyal has sparked a controversy throughout the UK and US. Dyal, member of Parliament from the House of Commons, known as the Father of the House from Scotland, was elected to the British House of Commons in 1962 and has received international attention for his vocal opposition to the invasion of Iraq. He came under fire, however, for accusing British Prime Minister Tony Blair of being unduly influenced by a cabal of Jewish advisors in an interview with Vanity Fair recently. Dyal has been accused of inciting racial hatred and was vigorously denounced by members of Parliament. Peacewatch spoke with him regarding his comments and the reactions from his colleagues.
The government of a great country has been hijacked by a small group of people, a combination of the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs and a number of Christian fundamentalists. Now, after all, Mr. Wolfowitz was writing about a preemptive strike against Iraq back in 1991.
But now, can you talk about the specific evidence that you have and the allegations?
I mean, it's the influence of Mr. Wolfowitz, Mr. Adelman, whom we see repeatedly here, Mr. Bolton, Mr. Feith, the president's spokesman, Ari Fleischer, and others, men of great influence. And what has really concerned me is the pressure for an attack on Syria. You see, what really disturbed me, I have to tell you, is that on the 13th of November last year, I did a debate in the Oxford Union Society, that's the Student Union Society. And it was to have been Tariq Ali against our Defence Secretary, Jeff Hoon, and your James Woolsey. Now, I have to say that Tariq Ali and Hoon opted out for one reason or another. I thought James Woolsey was charming. I was very interested to talk to him. I was taken aback by his speech, because not only did he talk about preemptive strike against Iraq, yes, he said, we're going to have to do something about Syria and Iran and Saudi Arabia and even Egypt. I mean, a complete reordering of the Middle East. Now, I think that's profoundly unwise because they are different societies, and I've traveled very widely in the Middle East.
I'm reading an article here from April 17th of the Chicago Sun-Times that starts out coinciding with the Bush administration's tough talk about Syria. A senior Israeli official exposed a smoking gun. Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz told the Tel Aviv newspaper, quote, "We have a long list of issues we are thinking of demanding of the Syrians, and it would be best done through the Americans." And the Mofaz's Hebrew language interview was not widely distributed in Washington, but a few members of Congress who learned of it were stunned by its audacity, with Prime Minister Ariel Sharon long having urged changing Iraq's regime by force of U.S. arms. His government now hopes to ride the emerging American imperium to regional reconstruction along Israeli lines. What's your response to that?
Well, you see, that says a lot. My objection is to the extreme Likudnik Sharon agenda that seems to be dragging my country, and indeed yours, into a war with Syria, which I think would be a disaster. Incidentally, I thought the war with Iraq has been a disaster, because what I'm concerned about is terrorism. And in fact, far from doing something about terrorism, it makes terrorism more likely on the long term, what's happened in Iraq, I'm afraid.
And so what role exactly do you suppose that Israel and Ariel Sharon's government has played in terms of pushing first to pressure the U.S. and U.K. Into some sort of attack of Syria, as well as its role in the former
I think it was huge in getting the United States to react to the dreadful events of September the 11th, when you had the sympathy of the whole world almost, and rightly so. And you see, what have you done by this bombing of Baghdad and the rest of it? You've alienated a lot of people who may be the terrorists of the next generation. And I believe that Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. Indeed, the relationship was that Al-Qaeda, on two occasions, tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein. Now, all right, Iraq was a rough regime, but I was there in 1994 and again in 1998, and we bolstered the worst part of the regime by having these sanctions. It was a very unwise policy. It really was.
So do you feel as though Israel played a key role in the invasion of Iraq?
I'm saying those around Ariel Sharon and his group, there are many, many Jewish people, were horrified at what Sharon has done.
And with respect to Syria, you believe that Sharon and the Likud party are continuing to pressure Britain and the U.S.?
Sharon and some of the Likud party, the extremists.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I've had a lot to do with a man called Dick Crossman, whose parliamentary private secretary I was, who was very close to Chaim Weizmann. I mean, I know a lot about internal Israeli politics. I mean, if Yitzhak Rabin had not been murdered, it would have been an entirely different situation.
So what are the basis, what's the basis of these suspicions on your part? Can you talk about specific evidence that you have that lead you to these conclusions?
The specific evidence is the United States and my country going to war against Iraq when the situation was containable. And I think it was possible to go on talking to them. If, in fact, we'd sent in businessmen rather than sanctions and bombing, it might have been a great deal better, and I don't think I'm being naive about that. You see, with the former Irish Taoiseach, who's well known in the United States, Albert Reynolds, I sat in the house of Tariq Aziz in 1998, and he explained to us, he said, "You may think that Saddam and I are extremists. We are as nothing to what will follow if these sanctions and this bombing doesn't stop." I really do think that we have created a hatred for ourselves, and the longer we're there, there will be sort of sabotage against British and American troops, and there will be incidents. And it will be the kind of agony that my country has gone through in the north of Ireland.
Are you aware of any movement to have Tony Blair actually be brought up on criminal charges before the International
yes.
Court?
Yes, there are. A man called Bruce Kent is coordinating this. And I make no bones about it, publicly and privately. I think that he is in the position of a war criminal. I think the war was illegal. And that even more illegal, if there are no convincing signs of weapons of mass destruction. I also think it is utterly appalling that the documents that were found in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and indeed in the headquarters of the Iraqi security police were not taken into public custody. Why they've been left, you know, for journalists to go around. Because, you know, we've got to be very careful about victors' justice. And if members of the regime, you know, are to be dealt with, we must make sure that it is a proper trial. Now, those documents might have been very important.
How has the experience of war molded your political opinion of the current events in the Persian Gulf?
I think this, that those who have actually been tank crew are much more careful about committing troops than people who've never been near a war situation. I mean, it seemed to us that Colin Powell, who'd actually been in Vietnam, was a great deal more careful than the so-called chicken hawks, who were very hawkish, but hadn't themselves been near.
Mm. But at the same time, the first president, George Bush, who did see some sort of combat, was not necessarily as reserved in sending in troops to Afghanistan.
No. Well, I think Afghanistan, again, was a mistake. Because, you see, I would have preferred a mixture of intelligence and bribery, which would have had far more chance of finding the fiendishly horrible Osama bin Laden and the people who did that dreadful thing in New York, than bombing the Afghans. Because the truth was that on September the 12th and 13th, there was sympathy even from the Taliban for the Americans.
Tam Dayal, Member of Parliament from the House of Commons, is the so-called father of the house from Scotland. Smashed cars, buses, and other debris littered an industrial lot today to represent the aftermath of a radioactive dirty bomb explosion for the most extensive bioterrorism drill in this nation's history. The 5-day drill, combining the Seattle disaster with the fake threat of a biological agent in Chicago, is aimed at testing the ability of local, state, and federal authorities to handle terrorist attacks. It's the first large-scale counterterrorism exercise since the September 11th 2001 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, D.C. The idea, said Mayor Greg Nickels, is for regional and national agencies to see where strengths and weaknesses lie. Quote, when a disaster occurs, people do not call the White House, Nickels said. At a news conference, they call 911. The U.S. Patriot Act, born out of the ashes of September 11th under the auspices of creating a more secure homeland, is described by civil libertarians and a growing number of American citizens as a war on the Bill of Rights. It's an assault on civil liberties, and it's primarily being waged against immigrants and people of color. 600 people of South Asian descent are currently being held without charge by the federal government under the guidelines of the Patriot Act. But all too often, their stories remain untold, perhaps ignored by the mainstream media because of their race and class, and because they're often fearful about speaking up. But one atypical victim of the Patriot Act has been speaking out about his experience, and his story has been printed by the Los Angeles Times and a number of other newspapers and radio programs across the country. Jason Halperin works at a New York-based international humanitarian aid organization. He stopped by our studios earlier today to share his encounter.
On March 20th, 2003, my roommate and I were on the way to a Broadway show. The show was Rent, and as we were walking to the show, we decided to walk in to have some food. We chose an Indian restaurant that I've been to many times before. After having our food on our plate, it's a buffet style, we walked down the stairs, sat down to eat the food, and no more than a few minutes later, five obviously NYPD with bulletproof vests stormed down the stairs, yelling and demanding, "Get to the back of the restaurant. Get to the back of the restaurant." Of course, I hesitated, mm-hmm. Quite fearful, mm-hmm. and they again stated, "Do you not hear us? Get to the back of the restaurant." They took Asher and I, and this is, guns were pointed mm-hmm. at everyone in the restaurant at this point. As I'm being placed at the table at the back of the restaurant, I looked around and there were six other people, all of obvious South Asian descent mm-hmm. besides my roommate and I. They sat us at one table and they then continued to kick open doors to bathrooms, to closets, putting the guns right in front of the door right before they kicked it. So if there was someone there, it would be a quite tense moment. And seeing if there was anyone else in the restaurant, They then turned around and pointed the gun right at the man in charge. I'm not sure if he was a manager or a waiter, and stated, "Is there anyone else in the restaurant?" He motioned to the kitchen, and the police then, with their fingers on the triggers, walked into the kitchen. I heard a slight commotion, and I then saw five men crawling out of the kitchen, with the police behind them still with their guns drawn. They sat the kitchen workers down at an adjacent table to us. After that, about 8 to 10 people walked down the stairs. Mm-hmm. As I said, we were eating in the bottom floor of the restaurant. About 6 of them went into the front of the restaurant and took out their laptop computers and just started frantically writing. Two other people walked over to our table where we were seated and asked to see our license and wanted, of course, our hands on the table. We were allowed to get our license, but to keep our hands on the table. Mm-hmm. At this point, my roommate explains, "We are just having dinner here. What is going on? We're very scared. We want to leave. And the man, who obviously seemed to be the spokesperson, walked over and said, "I'm sorry. This is a Homeland Security investigation, and we have the right to hold you." And Asher, my roommate, again states, "No, you don't. I'm just here to have dinner. I want to leave. Mm-hmm. And he explains, "We again have the right to hold you under the Patriot Act." And he did state the Patriot Act. Mm-hmm. They then asked for our licenses. Mm-hmm. He went to take my license. And right before he took my license, I again got very nervous that this could take... Well, you have the right to speak to a lawyer. But following a Homeland Security investigation, I'm not sure if he meant me
in this country
for me to speak to a lawyer. And that could take up to a month. Mm-hmm. I've found out now that there are people in the court system now being held, mm-hmm. that are U.S. citizens that are still being denied the right to a lawyer. They don't call it denied. They say they're in waiting, mm-hmm. to speak to a lawyer. But ultimately, it would take that long. And following what he said, I then gave him my license.
Mm. What's going through your head at this time? You've already been told that you may not have access immediately to a lawyer.
I mean, going through my head, I am incredibly scared. I'm looking around and noticing that they've placed me at a table with other people who I do not know. I do not know what the investigation has to do with. I also know that they are brandishing weapons, and at any minute this could become there could be bullets throughout the restaurant, mm-hmm. with me in the middle. And as well, I don't feel that my constitutional rights are being upheld. I do not feel that I'm in the United States anymore, mm-hmm. in that restaurant. I, mm-hmm. felt as if I was taken to a back alley and my rights were taken away from me. And I was quite fearful that I can be held up to a month. I didn't know what was going to happen after they took my license. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, I am so scared, and I am just praying that I make it out of here, not only alive, but not in the hands of, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. of the Homeland Security Department, who would deny me what I feel is one of the most important constitutional rights.
Was there anything in your past that you thought might surface as an issue under this type of scrutiny, trigger-happy or trigger-finger scrutiny?
Sure. I'd say it's one of those things that I was sitting there and thought of everything I've ever done in my whole life and started thinking, oh, my God, is that time I cheated in biology in high school, is that going to come back and bite me? Am I going to be taken as a national security threat? Mm. I mean, I was so scared and felt that that my rights were not being provided, and at any minute, mm-hmm. they could take me and tell me, you're going to, mm-hmm. be held for a long period of time. And that could be because of something I had in my past, or because they were going to state that I was involved in something because I was eating in this restaurant. Mm-hmm. As the story goes on, I find out later it was a mistake, this whole raid, and the people in the restaurant, as much as I can tell, At least a few of them have been released. But at that moment, I didn't know who they were. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we were all being put in the same position. And mm-hmm. I felt very easily I can be held for a very long time. I knew what the Patriot Act was doing, or I had some information. Mm-hmm. I knew that rights were being withheld from people post 9/11. But not until I actually had this experience, not until I felt as if my rights were being taken away, one, and two, I can be held for a very long time, did I realize the extent of what's happening not only to myself but to the hundreds of South Asian and Middle Eastern immigrants all throughout this country.
Jason Halperin describing his experience of having dinner at a Times Square restaurant when it was raided by gun-wielding members of the New York City Police Department. They were conducting a routine raid under the provisions of the Patriot Act. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we return, Halperin continues his story, including a lecture on why the raid is really for his own good.